these kids are quite mature in a way, because they live in very straitened, very poor, hard circumstances. So you don't get to be a Disney kid. You work pretty much from the word go. For the girls after puberty, because then they are a saleable item, and bride price is a normal part of the economy out there. It's an accepted thing that that's one of the things that a girl can bring to a family is if she gets a good bride price.
Welcome to Unexpected Turns. Today, myself, Anne Dibben, and Beverly Evans talk to Max MacDonald. If you may remember, we spoke to him a few weeks ago about how his life had taken more than a few unexpected turns, ending up with him being arrested and starting to support a school, the Uphill Trust, in Uganda. Listen on to hear more. Hi there, Max. Lovely to see
Hello. Thank you.
Hi, Max. Nice to see you again.
There we go. Oh, hello there. Yes, nice to see you, Bev. Yeah, nice
Yes, me
everybody's
too.
here.
And
Good.
that bike there, you were just telling us that's where you're going to be in 2 weeks' time. Where exactly is that?
This is a place called Depo Beach, which is just north of Batemans Bay on the New South Wales coast. And it's the closest part of the coast to Canberra. So we used to go there with some friends, a couple of friends of ours who were also on a bike. And we would go there to camp for a weekend from time to time. And we're going to go there. We're booked, not on a bike this time, but I've got a car booked in Canberra. And the two of us are going to go down, and we're not going to stay in this tent on that, but we're going to stay very close by, in a what do you call a safari tent.
Oh, like a nice, how lovely.
So it's a big thing. It's comfortable, but it's technically it's a tent because it's a canvas. But we're good. It's not roughing it like we were back then. That was 1985, something like that. So yeah.
Yeah,
I've still got
well,
the
we're actually celebrating our 40th next year, so that'll be interesting.
Ah, there you go.
I know. Now, Max, we spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, straight after you'd been to Uganda, and we talked about your life all over the world, but we didn't really talk about Uganda. So
No.
I would like to talk a little bit about Uganda. You touched on it a little bit. I've got the book here from your dad,
Ah,
Criminal
that one.
Shorts. I've
Yes.
read that, so I know a bit about your dad.
Right.
And the fact that you were born in Uganda, weren't you?
Yes. So my sister also, yes, as you'll see in there.
Yeah. And so going back, you left Uganda and you came to the UK and you travelled all over the place. And then, is it right that you went back about 12 years ago to really discover your roots?
Yes, I hadn't been able to get back. I don't know where I'm looking on the screen. It seems like I'm looking in the wrong place over there. Anyway, I hope you don't mind. I had always wanted to go back. I'd always been proud and happy to have been Uganda born, and it was something I used to be quite happy to for people to know. It wasn't bothered me. And I always wanted to go back because I heard so many tales that it's a beautiful place, that the people are lovely, it's a lovely thing. So I was trying to get back, but by the time I was in a position to be able to think about going back, I wasn't, if you see what I mean. Once I was old enough to start organizing my own travel and earning enough to make a trip like that possible, I wasn't physically in a position to do it. I was living in Texas, and then I was living in the Isle of Man, and then we were having children, and then I got to British Airways, and the holiday times that we did have, I couldn't commit any one of them to going to Uganda, and I was trying to get onto the right fleet that would let me fly there,
Yeah,
which
sure.
I did eventually manage to do in
Oh,
20.
really?
Yes. So 2012 was when I finally wangled it to where I started driving the airplane to there. And the kids also were leaving home at the time, and so things were becoming a little more flexible for us. So I went out first chance I could get to Uganda, and I was just looking for my roots. I wanted to find the places that I'd heard about and that I'd learned a little bit about, the names I knew. My memories, first-hand memories, were very scattered and very fragmentary, and there weren't very much of them. And I didn't want it to be all secondhand stuff. So I wanted to go and find out. It's all very selfish, really. It's all about me. I wanted to find my birth hospital if I could, find out where we lived in Kampala when I was being born, but most especially find out where we lived out in the iTunes, what? Find out where we lived in the West, which is where I went from 6 months old to five. So that's where I consider myself to be kind of, technically, I was born in Kampala in the capital city, but I grew up in the Kalembe Valley and in Fort Portal. And so I wanted to go and just find out and find dad's police stations, find out where mum worked. Put context, put my eyes seeing and me experiencing the places that we were when we lived there, and then see who I could meet. So all I was doing was looking for my roots, but I was able to start doing that in 2012. And because of the nature of the fleet and the business and my position in the company at the time, I was able to start going quite frequently, sort of every couple of months. Sometimes every month I could pick up a trip going to. Now it was only for a day at a time, maybe two, but I started to chip away at finding this stuff. Initially just in Kampala, because when we fly, BA don't fly there anymore, when we flew to Entebbe, we were staying in a hotel in the middle of Kampala. So I was able to start exploring the police department and looking for the hospital, looking for our Kampala, dad's Kampala flat, where mum worked, and some of the sites and places that they would tell me. So I was just looking at Kampala to start with, but I was itching to get out west, which is where I felt I had my self was out there. It took me a few months before I could figure out how to get myself out west. But the first chance I could, off I went. Hired a car and went off to the west.
And you said last time, I remember when we spoke to you, you said you finally managed to find your dad's police station and you
Yes.
blithely took several photos of it and ended
Well,
up.
I only took a couple, but yeah, I did and was immediately arrested for my pain.
Arrested, yeah, sure, yeah.
Because of this rule, which is not unique to Uganda or Africa or anywhere else. It's not an unusual situation that photography of government facilities is of interest, at least, if not restricted, if not forbidden, if not prohibited. It's at least of interest to governments if you don't have an official reason for photographing. And that can be military, police, government, all sorts of things. Now, the Houses of Parliament, that's a different thing. But if you go along and start photographing Wandsworth Police Station or a prison or an Air Force base or an army base, people say, what's your interest in that exactly? If you then, or if you beforehand, go along to them and say, I would like to, because then they'll have a look at you and go, you seem like an okay guy, and they'll almost certainly say yes. And that's what would have happened in Uganda if I had thought of it, but I didn't even think of it because while I was still only in Kampala itself, I went to the police headquarters a couple of times and I met some of the very senior, the number two second level and third level heads of Uganda police. Whilst I was trying to find information and archive material to back up Dad's books, especially the other one, which is about a very interesting murder case, which went to the High Court in the end. It was all over the papers and all that stuff. So I'd gone to the headquarters to say, is this stuff available? Can I have access to it? And they got into, oh, your dad was who? Let's have some conversations. So, and they were delighted that he was my dad and that he'd be there then, because they see, even though that was in what they call the colonial era, even though Uganda wasn't a colony, but it was in the colonial era, and the Uganda police was managed by people from the colonial police who were professionals and had set the thing up, but it wasn't the colonial police, it was the Uganda police, and he was seconded to it. And so he's one of the people that they say helped to create the Uganda police as it now is. And it's the same force, it has some new divisions, but I tell you what, you go look at the uniform, the main national uniform, because there are security police and traffic police and all sorts of different divisions, but just the main central uniform, it hasn't changed, other than they don't wear shorts anymore, and the badge on the cap and on the jacket, the crown has been taken off of the top of the shield. It did have a royal crown on it. That's gone, but the rest of it actually hasn't changed. So they feel that there's continuity between then and now. So they were delighted to talk to me about him. Really delighted when I told him he was still around and still strong and still going. So by the time I got to the Port Portal police station, the deputy assistant general, inspector general of police, and three of the assistant inspectors general of police were buddies of mine. So I went up to the police station and went, oh, hey, here we go.
And
took pictures. And then Cook and Dakwe Patrick, detective constable, very politely explained to me, or first of all, he asked me for my letter of authorization, and then he politely explained to me that I was required to have one.
And that you were under arrest.
That's what caused, he didn't use the term under arrest, but he did say, we will have to sort this out inside, you'll have to come with me. So we had to go inside. So I was in effect arrested, but he didn't have to throw cuffs on me or anything. Because I was apologizing right from the minute go. I was saying, oh my goodness, I never even thought of that. Duh, idiot, schoolboy error. I'm really sorry about that. And because it's my dad's police station and I just had a rush of blood to the head, and it's a digital camera, you can wipe all the pictures off. You know, I'll let you have that and you can wipe the whole thing clear off. And he had to say, well, yes, I get that and I appreciate that and I appreciate your apology and I appreciate the offer to clean your camera. But the problem is that the whole police station saw you taking pictures. And so everybody knows that you're required to have a letter of authorization. And if you haven't got one, then you are now in contravention of Uganda Penal Code, part blah, blah, subpart blah, 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 blah.
So were you panicking by this time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I only had one night in Fort Portal, and I'd already spent that. So this is me in the morning. I had to go to Dad's cop shop, run down to Kalembe, another 100 kilometers away, come back again, drive back to Kampala, which is 320 kilometers from Fort Portal, and get back in time to get changed and ready and check in and join the crew to fly the airplane home that night. So I was breaking
How was
it.
That resolved then? How did you get out of that?
Well, I didn't get out of it at all, actually. What actually happened was I was taken in, presented at the reception desk, and the sergeant, who's a very pleasant fellow, named James, got his pen out, opened up this big ledger, this big sort of old-fashioned ledger book. Right, here we go. Name, address, blah, blah, blah. Where are you staying? What do you do? Why are you here? And took all my details down, passport information, and then said, this person above has been charged with unauthorized photography of police premises. Mr. McDonald has admitted the charge, and it will be processed accordingly to his guilty plea. So I was charged. I did plead guilty, and he put his pen down at that point and said, okay. And was once he filled in whatever details he felt were necessary about that, because he mentioned something, I had an explanation about his father being a former policeman. So he put the thing down and he said, well, this gentleman, he said, pointing to Patrick, who had been the arresting officer, he arrested you, so this gentleman will decide on the assessment against this charge. Quotes, the assessment against this charge. And I thought, ah, here we go. Here we go, the assessment. So I start thinking, how much money have I got on me? What have I got that's worth happening? You know, cash cards for the bank and all that, because in a lot of Africa and in a lot of the rest of the world, it's not just an African thing, but it's quite common down there in African sense. This is an opening for, well, you can come up in front of the magistrate's court on Monday, or you might like to pay the fine, or you might like to pay a fine.
Yeah.
A charge. Mm-hmm. So I thought, right, here we go. And I'm thinking through my head. And meanwhile, all around me, there's all these folks from the station, other policemen, people walking by, people who come in to do business, some members of staff. And they're all gathering around going, oh, we've got Mzungu, the white man. We've got Mzungu, and he's in trouble. And this could be fun. And behind James was the barred door to the holding cells. Mm-hmm. And there I could see hands on the bars and big grins going, ooh, we might have a new friend. We might have a new friend in a minute. So I'm going, oh, bloody hell, I've got to be back in Kampala and I haven't even got to Kalembe yet and I don't know what. So this could go very awkwardly bad. And these people have me totally at their mercy because I have
no excuse.
Genuinely committed an offence. And so they can do what they want, really, legally and perhaps illegally. So I was not a happy boy. Everybody else was. But the atmosphere was nice. It wasn't like threatening or in any way intimidating. No, everybody was just having a jolly good time at my expense, which I thought was fair enough, really. Well, of course. How often do you get to do this? Yeah. So he then said, right, he will assess, come up with the assessment against the charge. So they had a conversation in, I guess, in Lutoro. And I couldn't follow it anyway. And then James turns back to me and says, well, this man has explained that your apology that you gave when he first apprehended you was voluntary, complete, detailed, reasonable, and covered, made a, I can't remember what else he said, but it was all those things, and given without coercion, and was a very full and acceptable explanation of why you committed this offence. So I'm going, okay, right. He says, as a result of which, this man, he kept calling him this man because he didn't think I could say his name. He said, this man has decided that that apology is the assessment that we charge against this offence. So you're now deemed to have paid the assessment in full.
Oh, great.
I was going, amazing. You know, my knees going a bit wobbly and going,
yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. Okay. Are you sure? Are you sure? Because I wanted this to be in front of witnesses. You know, I wanted everybody to understand that that was it. And yes, that would be it. That would be fine. And he said, so, Mr. McDonald, I am happy to draw a line under this affair. And he got a big 2-foot metal ruler out, put it on the ledger, got his pen out, and drew a line across the page.
Really?
So he literally drew a line under the affair. Then he put his pen down and his ruler down, and he and Patrick, between them, looked at me and said, now, tell us about your father. We need to know your story of your father, why he was here. And I explained he was officer in command of South Toro, just down the road. When he was in Port Portal, he set up the CID office, the first CID department in a police station in Uganda outside of Kampala. He was officer commanding that, and blah, 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 blah. I told him all about these things, how we'd been out on these years doing this, and how much he loved Uganda, and how proud he was of all his time there. And so that was, and everybody was going, hey, everybody's very happy, and it was lovely. So then, Patrick, after that was all done, Patrick said, let's talk a bit more outside. So he and I went outside and we were just talking about background. You know, what's your background? Where are you from? What's the point? What's your story? Da, da, da. And then he said, and one of the things I said was, I'm going to be coming here every time I can to look more into my local roots here, into my place in Colombia and the house up here in Fort Portal and all that. And he said, oh, well, you'd like to meet my brother. Would I? Yeah, and because I had said I'd like to make all the good contacts I can in this place. Because the more good contacts I have, the more it'll be easy for me to get on and find things and meet people and learn stuff. And getting on with the police is a very, very good thing to do.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's been very relevant to my story anyway. So I said, "Yeah, I'll be coming." He said, "Oh, you'd like to meet my brother?" I'm okay. And he said, yeah, he has a school. He has a kindergarten school down the road from here. And he's a really interesting guy. And he'd be very interested to meet you as well, because you seem like an interesting guy. So that's right. Okay. So he said, and I'll tell you what, I think he's in town. And he got his phone and, hello, blah, 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 have a wee blather. And he said, yeah, he's in town. He's just a few minutes away. Have you got time for him to come up and say hello? Yes. I wasn't going to say no at this point. whatever, anything to be nice. So yes, that would be fine. And about 5 minutes later, this gigantic grin walked through the gate of the police compound, followed closely by the man who was smiling, that being Elias. And he came over and we introduced ourselves and we had a chat for about 20 minutes, the three of us. And I really took to both of them. They're quite different personalities, but I really took to both of them. They both impressed me really on a personal as well as a professional level. So I said, right, I've got to go do this thing, got to get to Kalemi, get back up here, get to Kampala, so I'm going to have to run. But they said, oh, well, if you're coming back, here's my email address, because the people in there are forever trading contact details. It's currency, it's contact details. Here's my email, get in touch, and when you come out, we will meet. And we'll meet up socially. We'll go for a drink at the Gardens restaurant or a coffee or something. And we'll just get to know each other better. So I said, yes, I would do that. And I did. Yeah. Every time I went out, I contacted Patrick and we got together. We met him and Elias. And on the third visit, I was talking more about the school. And Elias had shown me some pictures of what they had, which was pretty unimpressive. Thinking it might look like a school. They don't look much as like a school. But he showed me, this is what we've got, and here's what we're doing, and here's the story. And it would be lovely if you could maybe see your way clear to helping us out in some way. So I said, well, next time I'll come with enough time and we'll jump in the car and we'll go down to the school and I'll have a look at it. From what I've seen in these pictures, I'll take some pictures and see what I think. And if I think I can help you in any way, I'll take the pictures home and I'll show people, the family, because I know they were already interested. They'd heard the story. They'd heard all of this story and all of my subsequent visits.
Yeah.
So I was very full of every visit. I'd go home with massive amounts of stories and fun and beads and things. And so I said, I'll go and I'll show it to the folks and see if we can raise something. So the next time I turned up, we jumped in the car, we went down there, and it was a Saturday. So I was going, fine, that's good, because all I want to do is look around the estate, see what you've got. I don't want to get caught up in class work or anything else. So I just want to look at what you've got, because it looks like you need help. You've got some ramshackle walls that Patrick and he had built, wooden walls, just wooden plank walls, and no roof, no doors, no windows, no floors, no furniture, but no roofs. And it does rain quite a bit in Uganda. Especially in the rainy seasons. So I said, maybe I can get enough money to get some tin sheets on your roof. They had one roof's worth of tin sheets that some passing tourists had left them money for.
Right.
Irish folks. And so that's what duly happened. Next time I came out, we jumped the car, we went down. I'm thinking, right, it's Saturday, that's okay. Just have a look around and then come back again. Of course, I was already underestimating Elias, even though I liked him a lot, already underestimating his guile and his sneakiness. And He's on the phone talking, but then Africans are always on the phone talking as we're driving down the road. I say Africans, everybody's, all young people are. But the folks there, mobile phone is how everything works down there. Money, banking, shopping, everything works through mobile phones there. So they are an absolute constant presence. Anyway, we're in the vehicle going down, and he's on the phone, so I'm fine. We get to the school, and there are 96 kids lined up in front of the school, standing to attention, still as rocks, waiting for the Mzungu. So in the last couple of kilometers, he'd been on the phone going, "We'll be there in 5 minutes, get them all lined up." And he'd already arranged for the kids. And at that time, he had a school roll of about 108. So 96 of his school roll of 108 were there on a Saturday morning, plus one of his other full-time teacher and one of the two volunteers that helped him out as well. So they were all there, just standing to attention. And they're all looking at me. Deadpan. And I got out, and I've got all this on video because I started videoing, and you can hear me saying, "This is unusual because they all look so serious. I'm used to the Ugandan people being so smiley and so welcoming and so friendly. Yeah. All these kids look really, really serious. Is this normal?" And they were, because he had told them, "You just behave yourselves. You stand and wait," because he didn't know how it was all going to go. So then when I said that, he said something to them in Luchiga, which is the language that they speak. And it was a case of, "It's okay, he's a nice chap and he's here to be nice and he'd like to see you looking happy." So all the smiles came out. Now, at that time, he had 3 years of kindergarten, P1, and had just started a P2. So the kids were from 3 to 7 years old.
Right.
So you put 96 3 to 7 year old African children in front of you, smiling at you, saying hello. Yeah. There is no defense. There is nothing that can counteract that, I'm afraid. He won the fight in that moment.
Yeah.
He won. He won right then and there. So then I had some time with the kids. They did a song and dance routine for me. They sang the national anthem. They went and did some stuff. I bought some little finger bananas from them from the Dukkha. And we all sat down and had a chat and played around in the playground. And then after about an hour or an hour and a half or something, it was time to pack up and go. And they all drifted off back home again. And we got back in the car and went up to Fort Portal. And I was already completely sold. Totally and utterly sold, besotted with the whole thing. And that was the start of it. And I said, "Right, I will get enough money to put change seats on your roof so you can teach in the rain." That's all I expected to do. But here we are, we built a whole primary school. That was how it started.
Wow.
Being arrested went from, "This is going to be really, really, really bad," to, via various steps, to the most wonderful thing that's taken over our lives after our children.
Because that was now 11 years ago, nearly 12 years ago, 11 years ago that was.
Yeah.
And that school has grown and grown. I know I get the newsletter sent on to me by my sister.
Oh, the new one just arrived, yeah.
That's right. And it's phenomenal how it's grown. And just,
I've seen projects there where people will build a school like that in 6 months, but they'll go in with a couple of million quid or a couple of million dollars, and they'll build it all, and it'll be some design that they've come up with in America or Spain or Holland or the UK or somewhere, and they build it and plonk it down on the ground, and everybody says, "Thank you very much." We haven't wanted to do that, and we haven't been able to do that. We've had to build, as we've raised money, I use the analogy, here's our box of money, but the box has only got money in it when somebody puts it in. When somebody puts it in, we then give it to you to spend. But that leaves and we need more people to put money in the box before. Now, we haven't got a pre-prepared box of money. We have to wait for people to put it in. So we've been able to build kind of a building a year once we actually got to the, "We're going to build your primary school." Because the first couple of years, we were just improving what they had and developing what they had and equipping what they had and hiring more teachers and all that. Then when it became unarguable, even to them, that where they were wasn't going to work. then it was, we have to write, buy some land, build a whole new thing from scratch. So it's been about a building a year since then, and we've been able to raise money at the 40 to 50,000 pounds a year rate on average.
Phenomenal. And you,
which
it's
we
not
are
just the school,
mind-boggled at. We're completely, pardon?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just you and the school. You've involved the whole community with this, haven't you? It's not just
absolutely
over
that's
here.
Why that's why it works, though, because we didn't bring in builders. We went to the local folks and said, "Yes, we've got people who build. They don't build skyscrapers.
No.
They build perfectly sound structures. So yeah, we've got local guys. Well, let's get the local guys building it, and let's find the local roofer, the local electrician, the local plumber, and the families would help out by coming in and feeding the builders, and then sending their kids there. They're invested in the school, and everybody and people would come in and help, or they would bring in food, or they would, can we help out with stuff? I see you're doing some fencing. Perhaps I can help you with that. That sort of thing. They've always done that. And Elias has been, because it is his home community, so he's already had the connection there to work with. He didn't have to introduce himself. They knew him and his mom and his family. So that gave him the channel to connect with them. And all he's done is he's opened the door and said, all right, my community, let's build a school. Let's do it together. And let's make a school that you can all be proud of, which they have done.
School, the children go slightly older now as well, because I know initially you couldn't keep them in school past six, wasn't it?
Well, yes, because Elias started a kindergarten, which is a 3-year process in Uganda, and they call them baby, middle and top classes. So you go in a baby class, then your middle class, then your top class, then you go to primary somewhere. So there was a government primary school, is a government primary school in Iruhura. At the time, it didn't work. It didn't function at all. But there were all the kids who were eligible that felt like it went there, hung around during the day, talked to a couple of local worthy adults who just kind of kept order about the place. But no teaching was going on. No learning was going on. But there was a school there. So he didn't want to compete. He didn't want to say that I'm in competition. So he said, but I'll start. I'll do the kindergarten. And I'll give them a better preparation for whatever happens in the primary school. So he did that, and he started teaching them the curriculum materials, because there is a curriculum for kindergarten there. It's not a mandatory thing, and it's not an assessment thing, but it's a curriculum of language and introduction to numerology and reading and a bit of fun learning, and quite a bit, actually. Quite a lot of it. And he did that, and his top class, after a year, his top class finished, they graduated literally, and off they went to the primary school. And a few weeks later, they came back with their parents in tow, saying, you've got to keep the kids. And he said, I can't, I'm not a primary school, that's the primary school over there. And they went, but they didn't do anything. These kids know more than the adults in that plant, never mind the kids. So you have to keep doing, because you're doing the curriculum. So you've now got a primary one. I'm not a primary. Well, you're a primary school now. Okay, well, you better get yourself a teacher. So you've got one. And they found a tree to stand under. And during that year, he and Patrick put these walls up so they could at least be in, kind of inside something. No roof, but kind of inside something. And he did primary one. And he used the curriculum, national curriculum materials, because he had been a teacher in the government school prior to this. Okay. So he knew what it was. He knew what it was and where you get it and what it was all about. So he brought the stuff in, he taught them, well, he and another lady taught the P1, and at the end of the year, every child passed the national assessment for P1. So then, of course, after the long break, the families came back and said, well, you got a P2 now. So, I'll get another teacher. And that was the year I turned up, when he had P2 going. So I saw them up to seven. But after another couple of years of us helping with the school he had, we were looking in at this elephant in the room of the space you got isn't enough. You've only got 5 rooms. You haven't got the facilities to get a license. If you haven't got a license, you can be shut down anytime at a whim.
Yeah.
And you probably should be, because they're trying to stop unregulated, scurrilous, pseudo schools, which are just there for children farming. So what are you going to do? Well, what can I do? Well, you're going to have to build yourself a permanent school, and according to the guidelines, well, how can I do that? I haven't got any money. Ah, right. Well, we'd been raising money already, and it was a case of looking at me going, you've been raising money. That's what you do. Just raise some more, and then we'll build the school. This was 2016 by this time. So that was how it evolved from there, because he only had five rooms. So I was standing there saying, right, there's P1, P2, P3, P4, P5. What happens about P6 and P7? Where do they go? Well, and that was kind of where the conversation originated. So we built the new school. We have them all in classrooms. We've had 3 years of P7 graduating now. They've not had a failure. Yet still every child has passed, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
To have 100% pass rate, and they've all been grade 1 or 2.
Wow.
One. Amazing. Amazing.
That is by far the best results in the district. And it's transformed the whole community. That their kids now don't just have a school to sit in, but have a school that they will come out with a qualification, the primary leaving certificate, which is your school leaving certificate in Uganda. If you want, you can go and live your life on that. First time kids in that community ever had an opportunity, other than going far away from home, to get a PLC and live a better life. So they're absolutely, it's transformed the community. It's an amazing thing to be part of, to watch it happening.
What age?
Top age is as old as you are by the time you finish P7. Any age up to like 16, 17. Yeah, carry on.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you get all the children stay that long, or are they pulled out of school?
No. Many of them are pulled out of school or leave on their own for various reasons. One of the challenges that Elias set himself was to keep the kids in school as long as possible, with special emphasis on the girls. He's emphasized the girls, which is very necessary. Girls' education, you have to push that more in Uganda because it's not been as well attended as or as well prioritized by families as the boys. And that has to change, and he's part of the movement trying to change that. And to the point that at one point we had to say to him, don't forget the boys. You know, you're putting all this encouragement and all this promotion and all this support to the girls, and you've got to teach the boys as well. Don't let them feel that they're just add-ons, that they're not important. You know, the girls are the focus of all your attention and all your effort. Don't let them think that. And also, this is an opportunity for you to teach the boys to be better men in Uganda than many men currently are. An awful lot of men in Uganda are not what we would call up to speed, really, on modern cultural norms. Not that they're pushed hard by the women to do that either. So the idea of women's empowerment is catching on, it's getting there, but it's got a long way to go. And so a school like Elias's, and he's not the only one, of course, but a school like that is an opportunity not only to try and keep the girls in longer, to get them further up the school and hopefully on through the school into further education, secondary, college or university or whatever, or not, but at least finish primary. Not only is it an opportunity to do that, but it also is an opportunity to teach more modern thinking, because it's not just because we think it's right and they're wrong. It's not a case of foreigners coming in saying, you've got to do this because you're all wrong and we're all correct. It's not that. They want it. A lot of people in that part of the world are looking for these kind of social developments. But in the rural part of the world, it's very slow in coming, as it is everywhere. You know, change is resisted by people naturally to an extent. And in the rural, conservative, small C parts of the world, it's resisted even more. So this is not an easy fight for him to push, but he is pushing for girls' equality of access to everything in education, equality of opportunity for everything in education, because it's all there legally. He doesn't have to knock any government walls down to do this. It's there, but it's just the society is slow in taking it up. And he's also, we're pushing him to this as well, trying to teach the guys that this is okay. It's not threatening. It's not a problem. It's right. And they should be happy with it, because actually they'll have a better life if they're in more of an equal partnership than the old fashioned men just drink beer and women have babies kind of thing, and do all the work, by the way. So it's an interesting thing, but you're right. As we go through school, still, where we start off with, we limit the kindergarten classes to 50, whereas you can see 200-300 kids in a class in some other schools around the country. We limit the kindergarten to 50. They naturally self-limits after that, as kids are either for force majeure, either because their families move or because they fall on even harder times, although we try and help with that, or because of whatever. But it might be that the girls get taken away once they're through puberty. They can get sold off for bride price, or they get home because mom has had another baby or two and needs the help at home to help with the new babies. And boys are often sometimes brought home for that reason, but not as often as girls are. So girls can get brought home for that. Boys can get brought home because, dad's run off, and so we need somebody to help on the shamba, to help with the heavy lifting on the shamba. So you're going to have to come home. We can't afford to put you in because now your dad's run away. Just an example, your dad's run away, and so we need you to come in and help us to keep making money and help turn the place over. Or you need to just go and get, guys say, I want to go and get a job. You know, I'm.
What age does that start happening? Around about 8, 9? How old?
It starts happening around then, but it becomes a more of a problem for the girls after puberty, because then they are a saleable item, and bride price is a normal part of the economy out there. Mm. It's an accepted thing that's one of the things that a girl can bring to a family, is if she gets a good bride price, then it's good for the family and it helps everybody, and it's a normal form of trade, if you like. So that's after puberty normally. The boys, occasionally you might find them being asked to come home when they're 8, 9 years old, because they're pretty fit and they're pretty sorted in terms of life. You know, these kids are quite mature in a way, because they live in very straitened, very poor, hard, scrabble type circumstances. So you don't get to be a Disney kid there. You know, you're working from the day you're born. You're working in the house, or you're helping your mum, or you're out helping her work, or you're out with your dad, or you're out just doing your own thing. But you work pretty much from the word go, in a way. And so they can go early, but it tends to be when, if they're going to go off and go do a sort of a man's work, then they do like them to be a bit bigger and stronger. So again, maybe we start to see the numbers dropping off at about 9, 10. And then by the time you're into P6 and P7, when they're anything from 12 to 15, we're down to about less than half of the class is still there. Mm-hmm. What's encouraging for us, one small note of encouragement, is that of those 20-ish kids who are still in P7, probably 12 or 13 are girls.
Great.
Which is really, really
good. Really good.
That's a small compensation that we are getting. We are keeping girls there, some of them.
I know you haven't had P7 for very long. It's only been a couple of years.
Yeah.
But have you had children go on to secondary school and?
Yes, we have.
We've had
three P7s graduated, and some kids have gone to secondary from each of those years. But when I say some, I mean maybe four or so. Now, the thing is that once you've got your PLC, if it's a grade 1 or a grade 2, then you can start secondary school anytime. You can go away. You have to come home and help out for a little while. And then when things are doing all right at home, you can say, I'd like to go and get into secondary now. That's no problem. You know, if you're 14, right. 15, 16, 17 years old. Charlotte Elias's wife, who's a very motivated, intelligent, impressive young lady, came out of secondary school for family reasons and then to get married and then with the babies. And all. She's finishing her A-levels now and she's 24, 23, 24. And she's missed a year here and a year there. But the year that you've successfully passed is yours. And then you go back any time to start the next year. And if you don't pass a year, you can go back and repeat if you want. And nobody is pointed. You know, you don't get taken to task by your peer group because everybody's doing it. So there's no shame in being older than your class year. You can't tell, how old are you? 14. Now that means you must be S2. No, I might still be in P5, but nobody minds, you know. Nobody
cares. That's good.
I mean, do you have any problems with having, you know, in P6, for example, some children that are 10 and some children that are 14? Is that an issue or...
Not a big one. No, not where we are. But see, our school is interesting in that it's one of the most relaxed, friendly, warm places. Most schools are still tending to be a bit disciplinarian. And so when that's happening, I think you might find a bit more of pushing and shoving going on in the playground if there's more pushing and shoving going on in the classroom. We don't have any pushing and shoving in the classroom from the teachers. At all. There's no punishments. The corporal punishment is still perfectly acceptable in classes in Uganda. And a lot of teachers control their classes with long sticks, which they reach out with. Or they'll have monitors who go around whacking juniors. But we have none of that. We have an entirely inclusive atmosphere. And so I have not seen or heard of any real problems in the higher classes with the big age discrepancies.
And what's the structure of a school day look like in terms of how long they're at school? Do they get fed in school?
Well, feeding is a big thing. That's a big problem for us. We would love to give every kid in the school a full meal at lunchtime. We can't afford to do it because it is ruinously expensive. But we have just instigated a year ago now a porridge club where we give every child in the school a cup of porridge at kind of morning break time, which they love and which makes a world of difference to the way their day goes. We do feed a number of what we have, which are supported children, where we have special needs, economic needs, supported children, about 29 of them, and we feed them every day and we feed the teachers every day, but we can't feed all 330 because the money is just beyond our means at the moment. But we've got in the porridge club and people can actually donate to that as a specific requirement if they want to. When they talk to us, we say, what do you want to give money for? You know, buildings, teachers, kids, whatever, materials. We'd like to put something into the porridge club. So we do give them that every day. The school day is quite conventional. The kindergarten, it starts at about 8:30 and it finishes at lunchtime. And they have sleep times and they don't have to stay in school after lunchtime anyway. They can go home. The primary kids do have afternoon as well as morning. They start, I don't know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, something like that, 8:30 maybe, sometimes earlier, depending if they're coming up to exams. But then it runs as a fairly conventional school that we would recognize as morning classes, break, morning classes, lunch, morning classes, home. So there are some schools, especially private schools, boarding schools, especially, which are very Dickensian, shall we say. It's, you know, they're beaten out of their bed at 6 in the morning. They're straight onto the work. They work them. They thrash them to work all day at academics or whatever it is because they depend on the academic results to tempt people to pay them their high fees.
Yeah.
So the kids are a means to income. for the school. Yeah. So they really are, some of them are, you know, they're in dormitories, in bunk beds, and it's all, you know, matron comes in at 6 o'clock and throws cold water on them or whatever, or just kicks the beds. And there are schools like that in the country. So the private ones can do kind of what they want in a way, but not as much as they used to be able to do. There are now much more reasonable rules and regulations regarding the operation of a school, as well as what you have to be qualified to be a school, which is now very tightly monitored and in a way it never used to be. So our day, though, is pretty good. And you walk in at a break time, you walk in at a class time, you can hear a pin drop throughout the school. You walk in at a break time and you've got the usual laughing cackling and rattling around, but they do really well, because the way the school runs, everybody's on the same side. And so when it's time to be pay attention and listen and learn, they do really, really well. You go in and you can go into a class and watch. You can sit at the back or the front and you can watch and listen. They're quite happy about that. The kids are not as self-conscious as they are here. They're not as shy as they are. I mean, there are shy kids and bold kids, like there are shy people and bold people everywhere, but the children as a rule are more relaxed about people talking to them or being there. You know, they don't get all precious and self-conscious and things as well. They tend to over here. I guess partly because they life about for them where we are now, the big posh schools in Kampala may well be different, but where we are, it's not about image, because no one's got mirrors, no one's got makeup, no one has hairdos. You know, having your hair done is shaved, your head is shaved, and then it grows out for a bit and then it's shaved again. There are one or two people, maybe probably less than 30 kids in the school, have got hair that is long enough to have a style. Everybody else is just shave-headed. So there are no mirrors, there's no makeup, there's no fancy clothes, there's no design or anything. So people aren't as self-conscious, because there's no, you're not going to be self-conscious about, you know, you're all.
No, same.
So how does that work? Because as you said earlier, you know, phones are a constant thing there. So they do have that social media.
Not really.
No?
No. To have a phone is not to have social media. That's a first world response. To have a phone there is to have an old-fashioned traditional mobile.
Right.
With push-button dialing. That's to have a phone. To have a smartphone has come in, and you'll get yourself a nice cheap Chinese copy of something. Those are out there, they're in the market. But to have social media means you've got to have access to the internet. We don't have access to the internet where we are. There is no internet unless you've got a device that will take the 4G phone signal and bring you internet over 4G. If you've got the plug-in for that, or the stick or whatever, that's fine. Or if you're one of the really lucky ones with a proper smartphone that can do that, or a tablet or something. So it's not there, but very few of our community have access to that kind of technology. We're bringing it in. We've got it in school. We have computer classes, which they we've got laptops that people have given us. They love computer classes. We're getting internet in. We're having a big drive to get equipment in that will suck the internet out of wherever it sucks it out of and distribute it around the school. We're pushing really hard because they know it's out there. You're right about that. They know it's there. They know what the possibility is, the kids as well as the teachers. They know that stuff is out there. And like everybody would, they want access to it. But
of course.
Do you think that's a good thing that they haven't got access to that social media? Because, you know, when I was a child, I didn't have people taking pictures of me all the time and displaying it everywhere for people to comment on.
That's a debate for the whole of society right now.
Oh, definitely.
And I have to say the usual yes and no. To not have it, yes, you're not prey to the kind of abuse and the kind of bullying and the kind of threats and the kind of mentally challenging and damaging behavior that is a part of the internet. And so that has to be a good thing. But it is such a resource.
Yeah,
such a resource socially, academically, geographically, oh. knowledge of the world, awareness, just to it, it's a resource that I couldn't bring myself, if I was given a button to push or not, to tell my community, you could have access to the internet, but I am going to forbid it.
Yeah.
I couldn't bring myself to do that because the benefits of it are huge. And to keep them away from that when all around them, the world is pushing it.
Exactly.
I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. So I'm afraid it's going to have to be there when we can, and it'll just have to be very carefully managed as much as possible. One good thing about ours being a slightly old-fashioned rural community is that there is still a lot of respect for authority. When you see the way the kids respond to teachers and to Elias, to people, they are still very respectful of authority. So if they're told, now they're kids, right? But if they're told, don't do this or do this this way, by and large, they will. Until they're in their teens, and then you can't tell any 16-year-old what to do because they know everything better than we do 10 times over.
Yes.
They think they're adults. Yeah, we had this conversation.
Well, no, they don't. They think they're smarter than adults. Adults have already lost their mental capacity and never mind their physical ability to play football. So, no, they don't want to be adults. They're teenagers.
I mean, it sounds fascinating, everything you've done. You're clearly very, very proud of it all. And rightly so. Is there one particular thing that you are, if you like, most proud about, or could you not put it into simple words like that?
If you're talking about, is there one aspect of the school that we are most proud of? I think it's the... it's the sense of optimism and positive ambition that the kids and the families in Uruhura now have. Before Elias started Uphill, it was a community that literally subsisted mentally as well as physically, just subsisted, just sat there. There was no opportunity for any improvement on their basic in the dirt lifestyle. And that's all they would aspire to. It's all they could aspire to. Now there is an opportunity, if you want to, and they do seem to want to, that you can either live there better because you can count, read and write, and you can negotiate, and you can understand a little bit about the way the world works and about how you might be able to make a bit more business out of the shamba that you've got, or you can look forward to the potential of going on to further education and finding a job which you now have heard about, because there's the radio, but radio, FM radio and AM radio are still huge over there, huge as means of communication. No one's got TVs where we are, except for the rich folks where we are, but everybody's got radio. Everybody's got the phones, either to talk to people or to look at. This sense that they have, that we have now an opportunity, and the families looking at their kids going, they have an opportunity that we didn't have, but we are now in a position to give them that opportunity. That is, functionally, that's the thing I'm most proud of. In terms of what are we proud of, the fact that we stuck with it.
Yeah.
It must
be daunting. Every year we go, how are we going to get 50 grand this year? We're only talking to you. We're going to craft fairs and talking to Rotary groups and putting out newsletters, and how are we going to keep that going? So the fact that we've stuck with it is what I'm most proud of.
Yeah, you seem very persistent, and that's what's got you results.
I have these little things that I put out to people. Oh, yes, the world according to Max. And one of them is, secret of success is not brilliance or big muscles. It's patience and persistence. Patience and persistence. If you got those two things, you can do just about anything. Just about anything,
Wow.
Oh, it must be amazing to be part of it, Mark, you know, and to witness the changes there. You must, you know, must
it blows
be really...
our minds. It utterly blows our minds that we started with this conversation I had with Elias in the police car park, and then the conversations that we had when Belinda first came out and saw the old school, and then when Lydney came out and saw the old school, and we were looking just to help that old school. And we think about those points of origin and now shift forward to walk
where
in
you
the
are now
and look at the place and go, this happened because... Yeah. We had those conversations, and Elias and us, between us and the staff, have been the resource that has created. We've just been a channel. One of the speeches I gave in one of the kindergarten graduations, I was pointing to an overhead power line, because there is one in Iruhura now, and we're now attached to it. And I said, we are the power line. We are the power line, because at that end, there's a power station generating electricity. And at this end, there's a school with people switching the lights on and making things work. And we are the power line, whereas at this end, there are people, kind, generous, wonderful people who give us, but usually less well-off people, who give us some of what they have, and they give that to us. We transmit it to you, and you as a community have made and are managing and are running this school. So we're just the power line, but we're very proud to be the power line. We're just the means of transmission of the means for this school to exist. And that's what makes us the most proud.
It's a phenomenal thing that you've done. There can't be many people that, you know, have built something so positive out of being arrested.
No, I was going to say there's quite a few people running schools out there, and we're not unique in that regard, but perhaps with not quite that same start point. Yes. I haven't heard of another one yet, not with that exact point of I'm going to arrest you, and then the next thing I know we're going to have a primary school. It's like, yeah, okay.
It's quite something. Is there anything you wanted to say, Max, that we haven't asked you?
Probably, but nothing that's rattling around in my mind at the minute, as in, oh, come on, you haven't asked me about this, you haven't asked me about that. No, I think because what you're interested in is just this process of an unexpected thing resulting in something wonderful. And that, I think, we've covered pretty well.
Fascinating.
thank you very
that
much.
Would be all right.
We won't keep you any longer because we know you've got to be our first thing to go to Australia tomorrow.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure both.
Thank you, Max.
I'm looking at you as if you can see me looking at you, and you can't. You see me looking up over here somewhere.
No, it's been lovely to talk to you, and,
been a
and
pleasure.
Have an amazing trip.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope so. We hope so. That's the plan.
Thank you to Max. Being arrested in Uganda doesn't normally lead to the improvements of hundreds of children's lives, but that's what's happened, and we are delighted for Max and all those involved that it is such a success. If you want to find out more about the Uphill Trust, do look at our show notes where we've got a link to the website and you can find out more. Until next time, thank you again to you, our listeners, and of course, thank you to Max. Take care. Bye. Thank you.